Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Texas Senate Committee revises school funding bill in last-minute bid to implement voucher program by Brian Lopez, the Texas Tribune. A drastically different version of a school funding bill that's being used as a last-ditch effort to enact a voucher-like program in Texas was approved by the Senate's Education Committee Monday and could get a vote in the full chamber later this week. The committee, led by Senator Brandon Creighton, Republican, Conroe, voted 9-3 along party lines to advance its version of House Bill 100. The fix is an attempt to avoid a special session after Governor Greg Abbott threatened to call for one if he didn't get a school voucher bill he liked. But that scenario might be difficult to avoid, with some House members furious at the Senate's revisions and vowing not to let the new version of the bill become law. The House's original version of the bill, authored by Representative Ken King, Republican, Canadian, only intended to allocate $4.5 billion in new funding for schools to give teachers modest raises and balance their budgets as inflation diminishes the value of the money they get from the state. The Senate turned it into a 133-page omnibus bill that incorporates several provisions of other bills that didn't make it through the legislative process. Most notably, the Senate version would establish education savings accounts, the voucher-like program that died in a House committee last week. The bill now costs $3.8 billion, with about half a billion going to the voucher program. The Senate's version of House Bill 100 would give parents who opt out of the public school system up to $8,000 in taxpayer money per student each year through these accounts. The funds could be used to pay for a child's private schooling and other educational expenses, such as textbooks or tutoring. Unlike the bill that died in the House committee, the Senate's version of the voucher-like program would be open to most of Texas' 5.5 million students, including those already in private schools, with a priority given to students who attend a school that received a C or lower in the state's accountability rating. The new version of House Bill 100 would also increase the basic allotment, the minimum money that schools get per student, by $50. That amount is currently $6,160. The bump is a smaller increase than the $90 that the House initially proposed and would not be adjusted for inflation as the original bill called for. Mandy Drogan, campaign director of an education initiative for the conservative think tank Texas Public Policy Foundation, said in a statement that the new bill is a win for everyone involved in education. Parents are empowered to make the best education options for their children, whether that's a simplified cross-district transfer process or utilizing an education savings account. Parents have the tools that they need at their fingertips, Drogan said. At the same time, House Bill 100 increases teacher pay and improves public school funding, creating a true win-win-win for everyone. But Representative Gina Hinojosa, Democrat of Austin, said the upper chamber is playing politics with critical funding and offering a measly increase to the basic allotment in exchange for vouchers. $50 is an insult, and they're trying to make fools out of us, she said. We won't pass a full-on voucher. Hinojosa expects lawmakers won't reach an agreement on the bill and will have to be back for a special session later this year. For now, a bump to school funding, which many districts desperately hope for at the beginning of the year, hangs by a thread. There is a full-on assault on our public schools by Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the leader of the Senate, Hinojosa said. I'm not just a no, I'm a hell no on that bill. Earlier this session, Senate lawmakers tried to pass a voucher program open to most Texas children through Senate Bill 8, authored by Creighton. It would have established a similar program as the one outlined in House Bill 100, but the House Committee on Public Education changed the scope of the program by limiting its eligibility to only certain students, like those with disabilities or those who were enrolled at a campus that recently got a failing grade in the state's accountability rating. The change was an attempt to make education savings accounts more palatable for House members who oppose school vouchers. That version of the bill never got a vote in the House's Public Education Committee. Representative Brad Buckley, Republican from Killeen, chair of the committee, told the Texas Tribune last week that he questioned whether it was worth bringing up the bill for a vote after Abbott's threat to veto that version of the bill. Some Republicans have tried to pass voucher-like programs for decades with no success, historically hitting the same wall, the Texas House, but the bill's supporters felt they had a shot this time around as they thought some parents' frustration with health restrictions during the COVID-19 pandemic and the way race and gender identity are taught in schools, something Republicans have seized on in the last couple of years, would give them the swell of support needed to get vouchers over the hump. In the House, Democrats and rural Republicans have formed a coalition to defeat such programs, fearing they would siphon funds away from public schools, which serve as important job engines and community hubs across the state. The Senate's latest play is seen by some as an effort to hold school funding hostage, essentially telling the House that if members want more school funding, the lower chamber has to agree to pass vouchers. The basic allotment has not changed since 2019, and raising it has been a priority for school officials after the pandemic rattled their finances and inflation diminished the value of the money they get from the state. At the beginning of the legislative session, school districts expressed hope that lawmakers would direct a portion of the state's historic $32.7 billion surplus to help them. But trading vouchers for funding is a bargain some schools are not willing to make. So you want me to make a deal with the devil? Absolutely not. I'm not making that deal, said Stephanie Elizalde, superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District. King, the author of HB 100, told the Tribune last year that he would stand against voucher-like programs. If I have anything to say about it, it's dead on arrival, he said. It's horrible for rural Texas. It's horrible for all of Texas. King did not immediately respond to a request for comment Monday. Other provisions. The new bill would also raise the portion of the state dollars that school districts are required to use to pay for teacher raises from 30% to 50%. The rest can be used for other school expenses, such as maintaining school buildings and buying school supplies. The small increase would not likely help provide substantial pay increases or make a significant impact on school budgets. H.D. Chambers, executive director of the Texas School Alliance, an organization of 45 school districts in Texas that educate 41% of the state's K-12 students, said the Senate is holding any meaningful improvements to our school finance system hostage until they get ESA vouchers, which ultimately is unfair to Texas students and teachers in our public schools. This bill positions private schools as an alternative for families unhappy with their public schools, Chambers said. However, the reality is that Texas has not made the investments in public education that would enable schools to fully meet the needs of every student. The revised bill also adds provisions from other bills that either died or have yet to be voted on. It would expand and give more funding to the teacher incentive allotment, a program that promises to pay teachers up to six-figure salaries if they meet certain performance requirements. About 13,000 teachers, or about 4% of the state's educators, are part of the program. The latest version of the bill also increases the base amount of money that teachers should make depending on their experience, and it seeks to tackle the state's teacher shortage by allocating funds to help school districts pay for more teacher residencies, which are programs that place would-be teachers in classrooms with mentors for about a year, teaching them how to do the job before hiring them as full-time educators the following year. According to the National Center for Teacher Residencies, teachers who go through residency programs are more likely to stay in the profession, with 86% still teaching in the same school after 3 years. In addition, the bill would allow teachers to send their children to pre-K for free in the districts where they work, if the service is available. Pre-K is not mandated in Texas, but the state helps cover the cost only for students who don't speak English, are homeless, or have parents who are active members of the military. Teachers' children are not included. House Bill 100 would also waive the costs of certain teacher certification exams when people take them for the first time. The bill would add funding for school districts to rehire retired teachers who, if they can be convinced to return to the profession, are seen as a promising workforce that can help stem the teacher shortage. Finally, the bill seeks to allocate $300 million in special education funding.
Obituaries. Margaret McIntyre, age 97, passed away on Saturday, May 13th. Her memorial service will be held on Saturday, June the 3rd at 2 p.m. at St. John's Episcopal Church in Odessa, with interment to follow. Arrangements entrusted to Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home, and in lieu of flowers, please donate to your favorite charity. Janelle Allen passed away on March the 21st in Springfield, Missouri. A memorial service will be held on September the 2nd, 2023, on their favorite country hillside in Haskell, Oklahoma. Michael Earl Gray, age 63, of Midland, died Tuesday, May the 16th. Memorial service will be held at 6 p.m. on May the 24th at the Kinney Underwood Funeral Home in Stamford. Arrangements are made by the American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Mary Laura Martinez, age 48, of Odessa, died Thursday, May the 18th in Odessa. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. on May the 22nd at Mid-Cities Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Pastor Daniel Hernandez is officiating, and arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. Ismali Ramirez Martinez Sr. passed away on May the 15th. Funeral Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Tuesday, May the 23rd at Holy Redeemer Catholic Church, 2633 Conover Avenue in Odessa. James McPherson, age 91, of Midland, died Thursday, May the 18th in Midland. Arrangements are by the American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland, Texas. Maria da Luz Rodriguez, age 69, of Midland, died Monday, May the 15th in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. May the 20th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Burial to follow at American Heritage Cemetery. Deacon Nacho is officiating, and arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. This is Thoris with the Odessa American News for May the 20th. The headlines: Family Motivates OCTECHS Top 2. Motivated in different ways by their parents, Ashley Enriquez and Javelin Zavala have earned their way to the top two spots at OC Techs. Enriquez, 17, is the valedictorian, and Zavala, 18, is the salutatorian. They walked the stage Friday night at the Odessa College Sports Center, 201 West University Boulevard. They have attended OC Techs for 4 years and earned associate degrees. Enriquez is in business leadership and Zavala's in criminal justice. Enriquez is heading to the University of North Texas to earn a bachelor's degree in real estate, and Zavala is staying at OC to pursue a Bachelor of Applied Arts and Sciences in criminal justice. Enriquez wants to become a licensed realtor. Zavala wants to go to law school and possibly become a defense attorney. I'm leaning more towards defense attorney, Zavala said, just because I know our system isn't perfect, and I want to give everyone that chance. Everyone needs to be defended. Enriquez said she is dedicating her degree to her mom because of the help and support mom has given her. Graduating is more like an accomplishment for her, Enriquez said. Zavala said when she got her associate degree, it motivated her dad, who was a police officer, to get his associate degree. We're in the same degree right now, she added. It's really exciting. It's like we're motivating each other. I see him doing it, and I've got to do it too. We're just kind of supporting each other. Hopefully in December, he might be walking the stage too, Zavala said. They have been giving each other tips and tricks on different classes. Enriquez and Zavala knew each other, but they didn't have any classes together. I never expected to be valedictorian, Enriquez said. Zavala said she didn't think they felt like there was any competition between them. We were just doing our job, just doing our assignments, turning them in each day. It wasn't really, I need to do this because I wanted to beat her or beat him. It was just, do the assignments, Zavala said. If she were advising someone younger on how to make it to the top 10, Enrique said they should find a motivation like her mom. For everything, literally everything, I would just think of her, and that would activate me, Enrique said. Zavala said you should have a system, because once you create a pattern, it's very easy to stay consistent, because even if you don't want to do it, you're going to do it because you know you have to, and you've set those steps in place, so you're just going to automatically start doing things, she added. Enriquez and Zavala said all the hard work was worth it. I enjoyed all 4 years here, Zavala said. It was fun. At first, Enrique said she was kind of sad that OTEX only focused on academics. She had played tennis in middle school at Ector. Zavala went to Bowie and then Crockett for middle school. She liked that OTEX geared their programming toward specific pathways. I appreciated having a step stool for my future, Zavala said. Instead of having to wait like everyone else in regular high schools, I already have my associates and the degree that I want. Enrique said business leadership helps across different fields. At first, she was going to go into criminal justice because her dad wanted her to be an immigration lawyer. But the first week she was at OC Tech, she changed to business. Principal Carl Miller said his top two students are both outstanding young women. He added that they are both highly motivated and dedicated. One of them is looking to go into the law enforcement and or attorney or a judge someday. The other one is looking at business and that pathway. They will both be successful. There's no doubt in my mind. We have a number of students who are doing that from our campus, Miller said.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram's oil report for Saturday, May 20th. Report says methane mitigation could create 35,000 Texas jobs. The story was written by Miller McEwen. Millions of dollars are being spent, and will be spent, addressing methane emissions. A new report says that investment could result in the creation of thousands of high-quality jobs. A report authored by researchers from the Texas Climate Jobs Project and the Ray Marshall Center at the University of Texas at Austin found methane mitigation could create 35,000 jobs in Texas alone, 20,000 jobs to implement the standards in the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed methane rule, and 15,000 jobs to address emissions more broadly, including 5,000 jobs capping orphan wells. The caveat in the report is that these should be union jobs. Quote, we think these should be union jobs because they are very specialized, explained Christopher Agbo with the Jobs Project, a co-author of the study. He said this would ensure the workers are well trained. Also, because the oil and gas industry can be volatile, it would ensure working conditions are safe and the workers have quality wages and benefits. Since some of the work would be funded with federal dollars, it would also ensure the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage requirement, which requires contractors and subcontractors to pay prevailing wages on federally funded projects, is met. The study estimates reducing methane emissions could increase employment in oil and gas drilling and processing between 6% and 9% over 2022 levels. The study also found the largest need for workers will be in the Permian Basin, which would need an additional 7,500 jobs broadly to address emissions. A portion of the jobs would reflect the immediate need for abatement and replacement of parts, while some jobs will continue into the future as monitoring and maintenance. AGBO said successfully creating these jobs will require collaboration between the industry, the state's workforce development boards, unions, through apprenticeship programs, and academia. Quote, "The key objective is to dispel the myth this kills jobs," he said. "We want to show cutting methane emissions is a job creator. We want to ensure these jobs are well-paid, high-quality jobs," end quote. Most of the new jobs will come from replacing pneumatic controllers, compressors, and storage tank parts, and jobs to repair methane leaks, and then jobs to inspect and detect those leaks. The shorter-term replacement and abatement jobs will be followed by longer-term maintenance jobs, including leak inspection and detection, leak repair, compressor monitoring, and storage tank maintenance. Those hired for these jobs must be properly trained, and the hiring process can take time. The report looked at a 9-year timeline and forecast a growing number of jobs in the first 3 years, with the largest number of workers, 29,700, in year three. Beginning in the fifth year, job needs for maintenance will remain steady at about 14,200 jobs. A small number of jobs initially in replacement and abatement work will remain to support new construction with higher regulatory requirements. Quote, "The time to engage in this work is now. Oil and gas jobs tend to fluctuate in relation to their commodity prices. Despite a significant post-pandemic increase in their prices, recent estimates suggest slightly declining prices over the next 2 years," the report stated. Hiring workers to reduce methane emissions now during this relatively low-price period will enable the oil and gas industry to address new regulations, end quote.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach, published Tuesday, May 23rd. High blood pressure results call for additional daytime meds. Dear Dr. Roach, I am a 68-year-old female who was diagnosed with high blood pressure at 32. I am 5 feet 5 inches tall and weigh 130 pounds. I have been taking 240 milligrams of verapamil for all of these years. A few years back, my medication started coming in 120 milligram doses, so I started taking one in the morning and one at night. My blood pressure both at home and at the doctor's office is often higher than I think it should be, averaging 138 over 88. Recently, I used a 24-hour blood pressure monitor, which showed that more than 50% of my daytime readings were above 140 over 90, while my nighttime readings averaged 118 over 82. I am still waiting to hear from my doctor regarding the results of this test, but I wanted to get your thoughts. Should I be on some other type of medication? Should I alter the timing to get better daytime readings? Answer. In my opinion, these readings are not ideal. 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure readings are usually 5 to 10 points lower than office blood pressure readings, so your average daytime readings are correspondingly higher. There is strong evidence that in people at high risk for heart attack, such as those who are already known to have blockages, controlling blood pressure to an average of less than 120 systolic, the first or top number, and less than 70 diastolic, the second or bottom number, reduces risk. It's not as clear for people who are at a lower risk, such as people who have high blood pressure without any additional risks. In my own practice, however, I will usually try to get my patients close to those optimal numbers, as long as the medication does not cause side effects. In a situation like yours, I would consider additional daytime medicine. More verapamil might be reasonable, but many doctors might use a different medication, such as a diuretic, in the morning to try to get the blood pressure optimal with less risk of side effects. Very often, the choice of blood pressure medication depends on any other medical issues a person might have. A person with diabetes, for example, gets benefit from an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker, so those would be preferred. Only your doctor knows enough about your medical condition to make a personalized recommendation. Fiancé's kisses make woman physically ill. Dear Abby, for Tuesday, May 23rd. Dear Abby, I've struggled for years with vomiting and nausea, as well as other digestive issues I dismissed as having a sensitive stomach. When my fiancé, Mark, and I started dating, he urged me to find out the cause of my issues. 6 months ago, I was diagnosed with celiac disease, an autoimmune disorder that is managed through a gluten-free diet. Mark has been incredibly supportive, and our kitchen is mostly gluten-free. I can get fairly sick, so we are pretty careful. There's just one issue. I can get cross-contaminated if he kisses me after eating gluten, and he does eat gluten quite often. It can be resolved if he brushes his teeth thoroughly, but he brushes his teeth only every 2 or 3 days. Mark is a grown man, and while we've discussed it briefly from a health standpoint, I don't want to be responsible for managing his oral hygiene. That needs to be his responsibility. I don't know whether to draw the line, though, without being controlling. Is it reasonable to expect my fiancé to brush his teeth after eating gluten? Or every morning and evening? Or must I just accept that I won't be able to kiss him except on rare occasions? Bad kiss in Kansas. Dear Bad Kiss, if kissing your fiancé causes you to have episodes of nausea and vomiting, as well as other digestive issues, out of respect for your welfare, your fiancé should be willing, if not eager, to modify his snacking habits. Insisting that he do what dental health professionals have urged as far back as I can remember is not controlling. It's protecting your health and his. Speak up. Dear Abby, my cousin is refusing to allow me to see my Aunt Betty. After a horrible 2020 during which my cousin lost her husband to cancer and the lockdown occurred that kept most people isolated, my cousin still guards her mom beyond reason. I've asked repeatedly if we could meet in person at an outside location and offered to wear a mask, but she refuses. My cousin said in a text that she's in charge of her mom's schedule. Her reasons when we speak are the loss of her husband, grief, and fear. My aunt is visited often by her grandkids, who live regular lives exposed to the many elements out there. And my cousin works in an industry where she's exposed to many people. My aunt is in her late 80s, and I'm afraid the next time I see her will be in her casket. After losing several people close to me these past few years, it is obvious to me that life is short, and we have no idea when our time will end. When my father died, Aunt Betty and her husband were very kind to me. I have always adored her. It makes me sad and sometimes angry that my cousin is doing this. I think she's being selfish. Should I say anything to her or just let it be? Missing my aunt out west. Dear Missing, by all means, have that conversation with your cousin. because she has a career that exposes her to strangers who could transmit a contagious disease, and she allows her grandkids to visit, her reasons for not allowing you to see your aunt make no sense. What does make sense is that she may have other reasons for preventing you from being involved with her mother. What they may be, only she can answer.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.